UFP, the United Federation of Podcasts.
Welcome to Franchise Fatigue, the little podcast on the United Federation of Podcast Network, where your hosts go through movies, remakes, and sequels and discuss them for you. Joining me, as always, is my ever-wonderful constant co-host who only has one personality that he shows to you guys, but to me, oh my goodness, he's got like 80. Zach Moore.
Yeah, I'm totally Zach. I'm not anyone else.
Totally. It's so good.
Look, I'm going to eat this candy right now with the wrapper and everything. I'm going to wipe it all over my shirt. That proves that it's me.
Would you be able to do that if you had multiple personalities? Would you be able to do that?
I would hope so.
Isn't, like, dissociative identity disorder, isn't that, like, a myth? I never looked into it, but I should probably
do that.
That's
very insensitive, Brandon.
I heard it was a myth, like, that it wasn't really a thing. I don't know.
Well, some people would say that the moon landing's a myth, but that's up for debate another time.
You're in Houston, so I guess you'd know that one.
Yeah, I know better than anyone, but I'm not allowed to talk about it. So.
Oh, okay, sounds good. Well, we are here to discuss the second movie in the
Eastrail 177 trilogy, Brandon.
Eastrail 177. Okay, I thought it was the 310 to Yuma trilogy. Okay.
No,
that's a different train. Different train altogether. And we are talking about the second movie in the series, Split, which shocking twist ending takes place in the same universe as Unbreakable.
Yeah, that will be where most of the trivia comes from, but before we jump into it straight up, I remember hearing about Split and like, hey, you got to watch the end. And then at some point I saw the only kind of impression of what the spoiler was like somebody shows up who you'll recognize from an old Shyamalan movie. And I just thought they'd be like an actor, right?
Oh.
So I was like, oh, is Mel Gibson or Joaquin Phoenix or somebody going to show up? Like, I didn't know, right? And I'm waiting and waiting and waiting. And the whole thing is like, it's over. And I'm like, oh, well, that must have been incorrect intel.
Yeah.
But then when I saw, I was like, oh. Also, I have a good friend of mine who's really into films. And he said when he saw it for the first time, he recognized the score for Unbreakable at the end by mm-hmm. James Newton. Like, da 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 da. And, you know, I hadn't seen Unbreakable in years, so that didn't click with me. But obviously I realized that, oh, they're playing the Unbreakable music at the end of the film. So regardless, that was its own tie-in. Even if they left the little Bruce Willis tag off, they might have been able to do it. But, yeah, this was shocking to me. And I think this is the way they should do, you know, cinematic universes, like backdoor, undercover sequels and connected movies. I think this is really clever because this movie stands completely on its own without that, without mm-hmm. being a sequel.
Yeah, okay, that's cool. We'll talk about that later.
we will indeed. So, getting to the trivia for Split, Split's production budget was $9 million. That is 88% smaller than the budget of Unbreakable, which was $75 million. So that just kind of shows you, well, I mean, that's where Shyamalan is in his career right now as a filmmaker. He teamed up with Blumhouse mm-hmm. And the distribution by Universal. So that's, again, the same team that's doing the Halloween movies these days, and then the Jordan Peele movies like Get Out and Us. So again, this is probably my favorite studio working in Hollywood today, just because, again, taking these high concept ideas, doing low budgets and low risk, high reward. I mean, look at The Invisible Man that came out this year as of this recording as well. Same situation, same setup, great movie. So
I haven't seen it yet.
I recommend it.
I know. I hear it's very good.
So with this $9 million budget, what did this movie make? It made $138 million in the U.S. and it made $278 million worldwide. So that is very profitable, which is what led to mm-hmm. them making Glass coming up 3 years later.
I got a question about that money there.
Mm-hmm.
So how much of that was opening weekend, and then how much was it on buzz of, you got to go see it just for the twist?
I'm not sure. I don't have those numbers off the top of my head. But
that'd be interesting to see if it like did better as it went along, hey?
Well, I know that it did. You know, movies have, you know, they have their preview screenings and they go to festivals and stuff. And there's a lot of good buzz about this before it came out to begin with. So okay. I know that opening weekend was strong. I don't know how much it made, especially coming out when it did like in an off season. That's where a lot of these Blumhouse movies come out. You know, the Octobers, the Novembers, the Januaries of the world. When the big blockbusters are, they either have finished or they're just starting, and there's room for these other movies to succeed at the theater. So, Now the main character in the movie, Kevin Crumb, it was based loosely off of Billy Milligan. He had a multiple personality disorder, and he was charged with three rapes. And he's the first person diagnosed with multiple personality disorder that used insanity as a defense by reason of that disorder, and he was the first to be acquitted because of it as well. He had 24 personalities, so the character in this film. I don't have the actual dates of when that took place. I know that he was born in 1955 and died in 2014, so I don't know what time of his life all these took place in. But he
probably had somewhere in the 80s, probably.
Yeah, most likely, and he had 24 personalities. So this was a loose inspiration for Shyamalan when he created the character of Kevin. And as we discussed in our trivia for Unbreakable, this is a character that Shyamalan had written into his original story for Unbreakable, but decided to save that for ideas down the road, which is what we picked up now in Split. Now, James McAvoy wasn't always the go-to choice for Kevin. Joaquin Phoenix was actually in talks with the production. He had worked with Shyamalan back in The Village and in Signs in the early 2000s. But they didn't end up reaching an agreement contractually. So Shyamalan cast James McAvoy. He'd actually met McAvoy at Comic-Con, funny enough, when McAvoy had recently finished filming X-Men Apocalypse and his hair was, you know, shaved for that film, as Professor X is in that film. And they had a good conversation, and Shyamalan realized that he had found the guy that he would cast as McAvoy. And he loved the bald look
as
well. Yes, as Kevin, excuse me.
Yes.
and he loved the bald look as well, because that has a kind of a neutrality to it, which can, you know, you can kind of project more onto that than you would otherwise. Now, Shyamalan, he, much like Alfred Hitchcock, your favorite director, Brennan, he cameos in all of his
films.
He's
not my favorite director.
Who is your favorite director? Is David Fincher?
David Fincher.
All right, very good. I'd say my favorite director is Steven Spielberg.
He's pretty good.
Yeah.
War of the Worlds is his best movie.
That's so wrong. That's so incorrect. That is so so wrong. So, but Shyamalan, he makes another cameo in this film as the concierge / superintendent of the building that the psychiatrist works at.
Isn't he like Hooter Boy in his when the credits go by, he's like Hooter Boy or something like that.
I did not pay attention to those credits. No, the character's name is Jai. And Brandon, do you think we've seen this character before?
The character? Mm-hmm. I don't know. No.
I would say no. We'll find out in Glass if we've seen this character before. So,
is this the druggie from the first movie?
We'll find out in Glass if we've seen this character before. So,
I'll watch Glass. I think I'm going to watch Glass after this.
This guy, man, is Brandon. So funny to talk to you about these when you've only seen them one at a time. So, yeah. Sterling K. Brown, I know him best from This Is Us. He was also in The Predator recently. He had an entire part as a character named Professor Shaw, and his part was completely cut from the film, but you can see it in all the deleted scenes on the DVD. We talked about the music a little bit at the end from Unbreakable by James Newton Howard, but originally Shyamalan, he licensed music from previous films scored by Ennio Morricone, who we are familiar with from The Good, the Bad, the Ugly, etc.
Yep.
You know, also,
etc. Nice callback to the movie there.
Etc. Thank you. But ultimately, Shyamalan decided that it was too old-fashioned for it. Didn't really quite mesh with what they were going for. So they hired composer Wes Dylan Thortson to write an original score. I had never heard of him before. I guess Shyamalan likes working with composers with three names, like James Newton Howard or Wes Dylan Thortson. But he composed the music here, all the music unique to this film. And of course, as I said, when the Unbreakable quote-unquote theme kicks in at the end, that is James Newton Howard's. Speaking of the use of Unbreakable here, because Unbreakable was produced by a different studio than Split, M. Night Shyamalan had to get permission from Disney for David Dunn's cameo in the final scene because they own Unbreakable. So I that surprised me too, because it was vague enough. Right, it was like you have Bruce Willis in a shirt that says "Dunn" with a name tag on it, right? Just to drive the point home. But also in that scene when you go, you know, title screen Split, and then we come up on the TV report or in a diner, you pass a coat rack and you can see the poncho of David Dunn that he wears in the first film. You see that hanging on the coat rack, so little nuggets there. And now, in order to prevent leaks of this final scene, which is, you know, the huge thing in the movie, right? That final scene was not included in the shooting script and also omitted from all test screenings for test audiences, like when they show it, you know, when radio stations are giving away tickets to see an early release of a movie, that kind of thing. So they omitted that from all the test screenings.
Oh, wow.
Now, in Unbreakable, we mentioned this in the trivia there too, but when David Dunn is, you know, trying to harness his powers, when he's standing in the crowd, he starts standing in crowds. He's standing in crowds at the stadium that he works at. He brushes by a woman and he sees a flash of child abuse. And, you know, the fan theory, I don't know if this has been confirmed or not by Shyamalan, is that is Kevin Crumb at his mother. That ties back into that. And I think that's, you know, probably the case because, you know, as has been documented, Shyamalan had conceived of this character and potentially what his backstory might be. And speaking of other hints to this character, the Beast in Unbreakable, the Beast, his description and the drawings of him by Hedwig in this film, they do bear a striking resemblance to Jaguaro, the villain on the comic book cover that Mr. Glass's mom gives him when he's a kid, and also the one that he's selling at the art gallery. So there is some visual continuity there.
I did not notice that at all.
There it is. And then finally, the words "Mr. Glass" are the last words in both Unbreakable and Split. So there you go.
I wonder if they will be in Glass.
You'll have to watch Glass and find out, Brandon.
I should watch that movie. Awesome. Good trivia. Thank you very much. I'm looking forward to talking about this film, but we got to start with the elephant in the room here, and that's that ending. And I got to say, I was pretty disappointed
in
the ending. Yeah, I was very, very disappointed because I knew leading up to this that this was part of the Unbreakable universe, and everybody's like, oh, you got to be here for the end because the end is so great. And I'm like watching this movie, and I'll tell you what I was expecting to happen as the movie was going along, right? I was expecting
David Dunn to show
to
up
come
and
in and fight him. Yeah, that's what I was expecting. That's what I was expecting the final thing to be. And so in my opinion, going back on this and my opinions of the first movie, had I gone to see this and not known the twist, I think my opinion of the twist would have been the same. And my opinion of the twist is I don't care. Like if I had watched this movie in the theaters and caught that surprise without knowing about it, I'd be like, so what? Because again, this movie has nothing to do with that. And all it does is tie it in the same universe.
Right.
That doesn't say that there's going to be another sequel to this at all. So, like, it's completely irrelevant that he sits there and says this, right? And so, therefore, the only way that this would be successful in making a third is if this movie was successful enough, which it was, for them to say, okay, let's make another one. Because if this movie bombed at the box office, we wouldn't have seen Glass. And then it would have been like, well, who cares?
Well, I see what you're saying. I don't think there's anything wrong. Again, much with our debate about Unbreakable, I don't think there's anything wrong with what the movie because of your opinions. But I will say that two things. One, it establishes that this is a superhero universe, right? That Unbreakable, you know, I mean, whatever his name is, the I think they give him some stupid name, like the Overwatcher or something dumb. I remember in all the promotional materials for Glass, it's some dumb name. But he, you know, obviously he has superhero-esque powers, and the universe that's established Unbreakable, people like Mr. Glass and David Dunn exist, and then for the Beast exists, and the reason he exists is because this is the world they live in. So it's not just some psychological, one-off thing. You know, they even mention in the movie, you know, they're gifted or better than us. There are things that are said here that echo things that Mr. Glass was thinking about the universe. So tying in with this universe is helpful, I think, to establish you know, what we're dealing with here. We're not in our reality. We're in this heightened reality that was established on Unbreakable. And I like the fact that it stands 100% alone, but it's also in the same universe. I feel like that is a smart way to connect movies without having to do the whole Marvel Cinematic Universe thing where one leads into another and everything is connected and nothing, like, you have to watch seven other movies to understand other movies. So I hear what you're saying, much like it with Unbreakable, but I don't find it an issue because the movie is not reliant on these things. Like, you could, like the test screenings, you could take out the end scene and it's fine. Completely stands on its own.
Yes.
And I like that about the film. And I don't see that as a, because they weren't, the idea was not to, you know, it wasn't banking on, like, oh, this is an Unbreakable sequel, right? And in fact, it goes out of its way to hide the fact of where it is. Like, you don't even know it's in Philadelphia. You don't even know it's in the same, you know, I mean, there are hints here and there. Like, if you really know the city of Philadelphia, you might be able to, you know, connect the dots. But there's nothing that says this is a sequel to Unbreakable. And all the strongest parts of the film are unique to itself. And that's just, to me, it's a cool tag that promises more. And like you, right? I mean, I wanted to see that. That was one of my, you know, criticisms of Unbreakable, right? I'm like, well, I want to see him fight somebody that's, you know, his equal. And this tag gives you the potential promise of that. And yeah, I guess if it had bombed, it would have been disappointing that we never got to see it. But I like the fact they put it in there. And I tip my cap for having faith in the product to say, you know what, we're going to put this in here. We're going to see what happens. And hopefully everything works out and we get a third one.
So do you think that this movie is the success that it is because of the tag?
No, not at all. I think that's a cool extra part of it. But there's so much going on here independent of anything to do with Unbreakable that it stands on its own. Like, I would still highly recommend this to people if it had nothing to do with Unbreakable.
Mm-hmm. I would, too. Like, my wife said she saw a trailer for it and didn't want to see it. And I'm like, I don't know. I watched it. I thought it was really good. It's a good Shyamalan film. Like, it's not too grotesque, right? Like, the violence shots are pretty tame, right?
Yeah,
they're pretty
tastefully
quick.
Shot, yeah.
Tastefully shot, which is a style that I like of his. I thought the movie was really well made, and I did really, really enjoy it, and I was really enjoying it the whole way through. I was interested in the story. I liked the old lady counselor lady. But, I mean, for me, I guess the problem that I had with Unbreakable and the problem that I have with this, so I guess this movie doesn't rely on the twist, but in Unbreakable, the twist changes your perception of the movie.
True.
Right? And yes. I really enjoyed Unbreakable and didn't enjoy the twist, right? As I said in the last episode. But, like, there's another movie here where I want to compare this to that I think of when I think of some of these Shyamalan films that are relying on a twist at the end. And it's The Usual Suspects. Have you ever seen that?
Mm-hmm.
I think that The Usual Suspects is a terrible movie. I watched it, and I thought it was the most boring movie I ever saw in my life, and it has a really cool twist at the end. And so everybody's like, this movie's fantastic! It's got a great twist at the end, it's amazing! And I'm like, I never want to watch The Usual Suspects again, knowing the twist, because I thought the movie was just terrible. And so that's kind of what I think of when I see these movies that rely on a twist at the end. As I said, this movie does not rely on the twist. It just adds flavor to it.
Well, do you think Unbreakable relied on the twist? The twist recontextualized what you saw, but it just would have been more boring without the twist. It's like, okay, Samuel Jackson helped Bruce Willis discover he was a hero. That's fine. But the twist is like, oh, he created the, you know. That adds another layer to it. But this isn't even a twist. I think a twist is the wrong application to what happens in Split. I think it's a reveal that this is connected to another movie, tangentially.
Okay. Well, that would be a twist, because the twist is that this is not an independent film on its own. It's part of something else.
It's a reveal.
Right. So let's talk, talking back about Unbreakable again. You know, like, so the other way to have done that story would be to know throughout the whole film that Samuel Jackson is the villain.
And is Bruce Willis going to find that out? That's the
And
drama.
Is Bruce Willis going to find that out? Like, that's the other way to reveal it. And I mean, like, I don't know if that would make it a better movie, because, again, I really like the story that we saw as it was. So, but I mean, that's the other way to tell that story.
Right.
So, and then, I don't know, like, adding the thing on the end here, it's like, Mr. Glass has been in jail for 15 years, and it's like, okay, well, so, I mean, I have a third one to see, but it's like, so he's not even a threat. Like, it's, would he still be remembered that much after 15 years, right, if he clearly went to jail right after Bruce Dunn called the authorities, or David Dunn called the authorities?
Well, I mean, he was the mastermind behind three very big, well-known catastrophes in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
And he got a catchy name from the press, mm-hmm. right? So I can see people in Philadelphia remembering that guy.
Sure.
But the whole point is, like, people are calling him the Horde. It's like, man, what was the last guy that had that name? Oh, yeah, Mr. Glass, right? Bruce yeah. Willis. So I get what you're saying.
The Horde, that's also a weird name for
well, these him. Are all weird. The Green Goblin is a weird name, too. You know, I mean, that's the thing.
Well, the Green Goblin, he's a goblin, and he's got green clothes. Mr. Glass is fragile, mm-hmm. you know, like
he's a horde of personalities.
Sure, I don't know. I just, yeah, okay, fine.
So anything else to say about the connection between Unbreakable and Split? Because I feel like there's a lot to discuss in this film that has nothing to do with Unbreakable.
Well, but that yeah, no, that I don't really have much more to add, but that scene is the reason why we're talking about this movie, right?
Very true.
So,
very true.
So that is the most important thing to talk about when discussing mm-hmm. this on this show, Franchise Fatigue. Okay, so where do you want to go with the film then? What else should we do?
I have nothing to say. I mean, really, the only point that this film exists is that it's a sequel to Unbreakable. So I'm gonna, like, what do you think about the structure of this film, the flashbacks to Casey, the main character? And we see her as a little girl, and because I thought it was like leading one way, and then it actually has no bearing on the actual resolution to the film. Like I
right.
thought, oh, she's learned from her dad. She's finally going to step up and defend herself. This kind of thing. It had nothing to do with the resolution, which to me that is a strike against it, because it seems like it's leading somewhere, and it leads nowhere, to a certain degree.
Right. Now, that is not what I thought was going to happen. You know what I actually thought was going, what this story was going to be?
What's that?
Was that Casey was one of Kevin's personalities, is how I was reading it the whole way through. So, we were being led to believe that this was her, but actually this was Kevin looking back, and his uncle was sexually abusing him and all this stuff that was going on in his past. And so he had that, right? So, and because his uncle is like, we're animals in the forest and naked and right running
yeah,
around
the beast,
and stuff. And
yeah.
The beast. So that's where I thought that story was going as I was watching it. And I'm like, okay, so I did just watch this the other day for the first time, but what ends up happening with her in this movie? She sits in the cop car at the end and she's just looking at that one cop. Nothing, right?
Well, no.
Because her dad is dead.
I thought that was very powerful, right? Because the whole movie, you're like, you're thinking, oh, at some point you're going to see how she either, you know, got revenge on her uncle, right? Because there's a moment when she's a kid where she's going to shoot him, much like the scene from Unbreakable with the kid and the gun. Reminded me of that, right? Her and the gun.
Yeah,
very
yeah,
different.
I was thinking of that, yeah.
Very different circumstances around these situations, right? But she, obviously, her uncle has been sexually abusing her since she was a little
yeah.
girl. And, you know, they're out hunting yeah. and she has the gun and she's like, oh, God, is she gonna do this, right? That doesn't happen. Then, tragically, her dad dies. Apparently, they have, you know, heart conditions in their family, so he dies. And the uncle's like, I'm going to take care of you. You're not going to be any trouble now, are you? Like, oh, my God, she has been, mm-hmm. you know, this guy has been abusing her for, I don't know, 10 years or however long it's been, right? Because she's a teenager. She was probably, I don't know, looked like around maybe 8 years old around that time.
Right.
So
I would say younger, honestly, in that flashback, she's like 6.
Oh, my God. So, yeah. Something, okay, what she learned from her abuse is going to help her overcome the beast, right? Or overcome whatever the situation is, right? That, okay, her self-inflicted harm is what ends up saving her in the end.
Mm-hmm.
But, and that is a message about, you know, the broken or the most, you know, or the most pure, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of the message of the beast. And because she was with these other girls, she just kind of got cut up, and he had been stalked, as we find out, he had been stalking these other two girls and figured they were like these shallow people who everything comes so easy to them. He's going to teach them and because she was with them, she was, you know, guilty by association from the Horde
right,
and the
right.
beast. But then when he realizes that, oh, well, she has been broken as well. Okay, well, you're pure, right? The broken are the most evolved. That's what he says.
Yeah.
And then he lets her live. I'm like, okay, well, that is a cool message, right? But that's not, I don't think, that's not at all what I thought it was leading toward, right? But her, because her street smarts, her savvy, because, like, even the very first situation where Dennis, one of the personalities, comes in and he's, you know, gonna do something, you know, either just strip one of the girls down or have her dance or whatever he was gonna do to her, she tells her to pee on herself, and she knows to do that because she's been a victim of abuse, and that gets abusers off. So I thought those kind of skills were going to play into her being able to outwit and outsmart the beast. And even her with her dad, like, you know, talking when she's a little kid, she's like, oh, the females of the species are smarter than the males. And I thought that's what was going to all play in. But that didn't happen at all. So that was disappointing to me. I thought there was going to be some kind of connection there between those two plot lines. But I'm sorry, to wrap around back to your question of her in the car. I like that because it kind of leaves you in that moment with her, because you're like, oh, your guardian's here. Oh, maybe she doesn't have her uncle. And then the cop finishes and says, your uncle's here. You're like, oh, no, she's been the whole time. But she stops and they have that, you know, kind of eye contact. And you're like, well, is she going to say something? Is she not? It leaves you in that moment. And I like it leaves you hanging there, because you're like, what would you do in that situation, right? Like, that puts you in that mindset of her. And if had we not, spoilers, we do see her again in Glass, but had we not seen her again, I would have been fine with leaving her story there to kind of pose the question to you, right? You know, if you know people in that situation, if you are that person, right, that puts you in that situation, and you're like, wow, what would she do? What is she going to do? So I liked how they kind of left it unsaid there, because she hesitates, and you can read into that what you will. So
Yeah, I guess I don't know what I thought she did, but I'm like, what happened? Because that was a big question that I had at the end. Yeah, it is. She is an interesting character in that she does have this ability, and these other two girls, they don't know what to do, and I mean, like, you can't expect them to know because they're young teenagers. They're in high school still, right? So you can't expect them to know what to do in that situation. But, like another weird thing that I thought about this was that he worked in this zoo. And
which they don't reveal to the very end either. They're little hints, like, it's a result of your time in this place, right? And and also all these random animal trivia that that they say sometimes. You know, like Patricia, when she's like making a sandwich, like, did you know that a tiger can eat, you know, 300 pounds a day or something like that? So.
And so it's kind of weird that he's got access to this area that nobody has access to until the very end, when they find her in the thing, right? There's like somebody who comes down there for a smoke.
He lives there as well, which is interesting. I mean, they established he's worked there for 10 years, so I assume he's had time to kind of build up this environment. It's kind of like a Phantom of the Opera situation, right? Like, he's living in the basement and he can customize all this stuff and nobody goes down there, and I guess he's like the maintenance guy or whatever, so they just let him do whatever. That seems to be the zoo is a public place. So I think at some point, I mean, I guess he had soundproof rooms, and who knows how long he'd be doing stuff like this, or how this soon had come to his head, because like he has his own like area where he's like recording his journals and all that. But then Hedwig has a room, like a kid's room, and has these like animal toys in it, which again kind of gives you, watching it again, you can see, oh, well, this is a zoo. Okay. That makes sense. That is something that is, you just kind of roll with it, but I see that point as well.
Yeah, it doesn't take away from the enjoyment of the film to me, but it was odd. I'm like, this is weird that he's living in this zoo and he's got this whole setup there. I mean, like, I guess, you know, when you look back on it, when the counselor comes there and she's like, this place is closed, right? The taxi drops her off and she's like, I'll be fine.
Yeah.
And he's got the fence around it, the gate, and it's like, what, does he live in a mansion or something? I guess that he's got this private gate. So, I mean, they played it up enough that when you watch through the movie again, it makes sense, right? It's not a twist that comes out of nowhere. There's the seeds are laid throughout the film.
Right. And then that all makes sense later too. You're like, well, where are they? Like, when she's running around at the end and there's like cages and she's closing them, like, what is this place? Right. So it does all track in that regard. But yeah, though, what's your, do you have a favorite personality of the 24? Our most memorable?
Geez, I don't know. I guess probably Patricia, right? Because, I mean, I'm glad that they didn't leave it as, like, it was a mystery until the end that he had all these multiple personalities. Because I didn't know where this movie was going, right? Mm-hmm. I knew that this character had multiple personalities. And so, knowing those twists, I'm glad that they turned out to not be twists, right? Because the first time it's shown... to us that he has a multiple personality, right? Because they could have done it like in Psycho, like a spoiler for Psycho.
All voices, right? Yeah.
Right. It's all voices. Like, this is a spoiler for Psycho, which is like 60 some years old now, right? But when they show Norman Bates arguing with his mom and you're outside the house looking up, you hear two distinct voices, right? There's a male voice and a female voice. And they could have done that with this, but like as soon as I saw they were looking through and they saw like women's shoes and stuff, I'm like, well, that's him. And then he opens the door right away. So I'm really glad that that happened. So
yeah.
I guess it was probably a bad thing coming into this movie knowing so much about it, because I was like anticipating the film the whole time watching it, and I wasn't really enjoying it for what it was. So I think that knowing the twists was definitely a detractor.
Well, yeah, you're waiting for David Dunn to show up, right? No, I follow you. Yeah. Because when I saw it, I'm like, okay, this is a story about these young girls who get kidnapped and how they're going to have to, you know, work their way out of this situation with this crazy guy who has multiple personalities. Like, that's the only framework I'm looking at it when I saw it the first time in the theater. And you have all this baggage of, like, we're doing a trilogy, you know, about this. So yes. How does it all connect? I got you.
So, now, I didn't know that Bruce Willis was in this movie. I knew that it connected to Unbreakable, but I didn't know how. So, I didn't know that in the final scene, Bruce Willis was going to show up. I did not know that. So that's why I'm like, I was expecting David Dunn to save them the way that he saved the family in the first film, right? But if Mr. Glass had shown up at the end of this movie, that would have been another way that it could have.
I'm going to talk to you about the Avengers Initiative.
Yeah, something like that. So. Anyway, so getting back to your question, which led to this tangent, I would say probably the Patricia character would have been my favorite of the personalities that we saw. Mm-hmm. You?
Oh, I'm going to have to go with Hedwig, little boy. Yeah, because he's...
You might be pregnant now.
Yeah, I love that, right? When I was a kid, that's what I thought. You know, when I was a little kid, really watching, seeing something on TV, some people kissing, I'm like, oh, is that how people get pregnant, right? But this is what kids think. It's so funny. I mean, I got to say, James McAvoy, man, I think... Hot take, I don't know, but I think he should have been nominated for an Academy Award for this. I think he did so good with these all of these personalities, and especially the scenes where he just goes like from one to another, all in one continuous flow. Like when she says his name for the first time, and he turns into Kevin, and then all the other people start trying to take over. You know, it's like, oh, how do you know? Listen, he doesn't know what he's talking about, right? And he just goes through all these this gauntlet of personalities. I think it was really good because you could, even without him saying anything, you could tell what personality it was. Like, especially like when Patricia takes over, get to the end, she just kind of straightens the blanket around her. And I don't know. Yeah. I think he was amazing in this movie. I think this movie works so well because of him. And you're sold on these personalities and performances that he gives through all these personalities.
I think he did good. I don't think it's Academy Award worthy, but I think he did good.
Not a win, but so. A nomination. You know, I would be in order, I think. I just think it's the horror genre. So they're not, you know. The Academy does not, you know, it doesn't look fondly upon
these. Is this a horror movie?
A thriller? I mean, there's a monster in
thriller?
It.
Thriller?
The Beast!
Psychological thriller?
Did it the surprise beast? You that there was a real beast? Like, did you think it was just going to be, like, heavily implied and you weren't really going to know? But you see him crawling around on the walls and getting shot. I mean, yeah, I mean, he exists.
So. No, I knew that we would see it at the end because they had dropped so many clues in there. That when the older lady, the psychologist, was talking, they're like, you can have a personality that has diabetes and one that doesn't. You can have one that, like, you can... She said something about it being impenetrable to something, like the skin was tougher on one than the other. And I'm like, that's going to play in at some point that they're going to try and shoot him or something. And it won't hurt him. And it ended up being that she tried to stab him and it didn't hurt him. Mm-hmm. So I was totally expecting it to come through because of the way that the psychologist was talking the whole movie.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then especially when it's confirmed as the Unbreakable universe, it was like, oh, okay. Superheroes and supervillains, right? Because he goes to the train, right? I mean, that's as we find out in the third one, that they truly connect the dots and reveal how everything is truly connected with the train. So. Yeah. And,
I wanted to tell you about that. I was expecting more with the train as well, right? So, like, I guess, yeah, there was some loose thing that they mentioned the train a couple of times, right, through it?
He goes to the, for the beast to be born, he goes to the train station, right? And that's when his father left, right? And mm-hmm. so that is, you know, when all this multiple personality stuff started, because he was left with his mom and his mom was abusive, and to defend himself, you know, his mind created this fractured personalities, and that is the birth face of the beast, because the beast lives at the train yard, apparently, is what they mention here.
So. Right. So, okay, so yes, now, thank you for reminding me, because when that was talked about, I was actually expecting him to end up being the kid from the first movie, like David Dunn's kid, where, you know, David Dunn and his wife split. They split up. So I kept expecting the twist. I was anticipating it and watching for it, but that's what I thought was also going to be at the end, that this turned out to be David Dunn's son from the first movie. So anyways, yeah, that's what I was thinking about when they were talking about that.
Right. Well, you know, even the a lot of the imagery with in the marketing of this, right, with the posters and whatnot, they had like the broken glass, and you're like, oh, mm-hmm. they split, that makes sense. But no, if you look at it next to Unbreakable, it fits on the shelf right next to it, and of course, glass carries on that as well. So there are connections, but they're not the connections that you were looking for. And I think maybe that's why Shyamalan. I need to go revisit his movies that I skipped, because I think people. You know, they got in this habit, like you were with this, like you're sitting there waiting to see the twists and all that. I'm like, no, just take a step back, look at what mm-hmm. story they're telling you, and not try to like, oh, well, I got it figured out, right? And that's what people do. I mean, but, you know, he did start, his selling point was his twist, right? It wasn't like, you know, people say that with The Twilight Zone. Not every episode of The Twilight Zone is a twist, right? Mm-hmm. But people seem to think so. So like, oh, I'm sitting there waiting for the twist. Doesn't always happen. Shyamalan, right. Literally every single one of his movies has some kind of twist, if not multiple ones. So of course, when you train the audience to do that, that's what they're going to do.
I don't think Happening has a twist. Happening doesn't have a twist. No.
I haven't seen that.
That's maybe why I like it so much. Yeah. I don't know. You
but
should see it.
I guess, you know, with this one, the twist without the Bruce Willis Unbreakable connection, right, is that the beast is real, right? I guess that would say that would be the twist, because you think, oh, this guy's crazy, and he is crazy. But there's a lot of unsettling stuff in here, like even way before when you know what the intentions are of all the personalities, when he goes to see the psychiatrist the first time, he's like, so you live here by yourself?
Yes.
I'm like, ooh, what's gonna happen here? That never plays into anything, but it like it puts you on
it's
ease
unsettling.
With this guy. Yeah. And she's an interesting character, yeah.
My favorite thing that happens in this movie, I think my favorite moment in this film, is when the psychologist goes over to her computer and there's 20 emails from him, right? And they're all like minute after minute after minute. And at that point, you're like, you know that every single one of his personalities has just sent an email.
Yeah.
I love that. I think that was a really cool image. I really love that a lot. That was a great scene. And she realizes it too, obviously, right? Because mm-hmm. up until then, he kept calling for these emergency sessions and whatnot. And it was done by a different personality every time. But the one guy, Derek?
Dennis.
Is that it? Dennis kept taking over at the last minute. But yeah, it was really cool to see that 20 emails, bang, 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 bang. It was really cool.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Loved it.
Do you think, did we ever see Barry? maybe, I guess not. Now that I think about it, because Barry is the, you know, the fashion designer, right? I always assume we saw him for real in the first session, but maybe we didn't. Maybe that was Dennis impersonating him there as well, because he almost forgets his notebook. She's like, you're usually so protective about your notebook. He's like, oh, yeah. So I guess you're right. He did a better job of fooling her the first time than the second couple times, for sure. So, but I think that as far as the personalities go, you know, I know that's it's tricky, because that's like a real world thing, although you seem to think it's not.
Well, you just said that it's based on one, so maybe I'm wrong.
Well,
I don't know.
Who truly knows what happens inside the human brain, right? So I guess that's a, you know, more difficult thing to manage. But once you understand that this is like a superhero world, you're like, oh, okay, you can go with it.
Right, right.
So, but yeah, any other last thoughts on the film? I guess the last thing I wanted to mention, we hadn't mentioned yet, is the other two teenage girls. I think they play them pretty smart. Like even at the first scene, you're like, they're not. You think they're going to be like these generic, mm-hmm. you know, spoiled girls, and to some extent they are, but they're not really. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. they even go to the length of like they invited Casey to the party, right? Because like they didn't want to exclude her, make her feel worse. They offer her the ride home. They try to work together. So mm-hmm. you know, I think watching it the first time, I was like, oh, they're going to play up how like, you know, they're all sheltered and. and spoiled, and Casey's not, and she's going to survive in the yard, and they're going to, you know, like in these horror films, like, oh, well, you deserve your fate. Like the people in Friday the 13th, right? They get slaughtered by Jason Voorhees. But that's really not what they're played pretty sympathetically, and I like that balance of, like, these are real people. They're not just caricatures.
Right. And, you know, going back, once you know the whole story, it's interesting to, you know, like, they're judging her as a character, that she's always getting in trouble and whatnot, and we kind of get a little bit of her talking about the character, why she goes to the detention so frequently.
Right.
And, you know, it's interesting to know, like, there's a reason that she's like that, you know, that they don't take the time to get to know her, right? They just, because she's odd, they just choose to ignore her, but they can't just not invite her. And, you know, in this day and age, that's true. Like, you can't just invite, you know, 23 out of 24 of your students that you go to school with to your party, because then, you know, then you got a whole other issues to deal with. So,
yeah. And I thought, you know, it's that sequence where, well, eventually all three of them get separated in different rooms because they keep trying to escape. And one of the girls has the hanger and she's trying to undo the lock. And the other girl's like, we can do this. We're going to get out of here. We're going to get Casey. We're going to be home on that couch. You're going to wear that sweater we laugh about. And in, like, most other movies, that's like, they would get out, right? Mm-hmm. Because that's how movies work. But no, this is not your average movie. They get killed by the beast and you're like, damn. Because you're set up not to like them just because they're not Casey. But you start to realize they're just normal people. And you really feel bad for them when they get killed by the beast.
I can't picture them being able to open that door that way.
Well, they didn't do it, Brandon. So you, but you know what I'm saying. Though, in a real movie, you know, that's how they would have gotten out, right?
Oh, this is not a real movie. Is that what you're saying?
Well, yeah, in a typical, you know what I'm saying. One character's give. Okay, in so many Hollywood movies, right? One character's giving the other character the pep talk, and that's what gives them the, and they get it out at the last second, and they escape. Not here. I appreciated that to mix
I'm
up the
tweeting,
formula.
I'm tweeting Shyamalan right now saying that you don't think this is a real movie. You're going to hurt his feelings. So.
Oh, man. So any final thoughts then on Split, Brandon?
No, I think that about does it. And I'm actually, you know, I'm looking forward to watching Glass. I am really looking forward to seeing where this goes.
Very good. So, Well, I have a question for you, Brandon.
Mm.
How many times is Israel 177 referenced or seen or mentioned in this movie?
I think three.
You think three?
Yeah.
Tell me which three you think.
So there was, I don't know, like there was just vague references. Like they, when they were talking about trains and stuff like this. I don't even, you know what? I can't even tell you why I think the number three. I just think it's three.
All right.
Am I right?
Well, it's actually zero as far as I could tell, because they mentioned that no one says anything about what company or what line it was. They just say train. So no one says, like, I was looking very carefully, like, rewound and listened to, like, the announcements. I looked at the train. It was, like, an Amtrak that he goes to. So maybe Israel went out of business after Unbreakable. I don't know. But
well, okay, so I took one of the counts for sure as the train reference that they were talking about, where his dad left or whatever, had to do with that train.
But they never say any proper nouns. So that's what
zero it is.
That's zero it is.
Zero.
This was my category, and Split has failed me in this way. But I know we'll come back around to it. So that's going to keep us at nine so far.
Okay.
The nine from the first film.
Let me ask you a question.
Go ahead.
How would you rate this movie?
What an unexpected question, Brandon. I hadn't thought about that. I would also give this 4.5 glass canes. I think it's a half step away from being perfect. I feel like had they tied more of what they were setting up together with the resolution again, I think that's the one thing that keeps it from being a 5 out of 5 for me, is this buildup of the Casey character when ultimately she had no agency in her own survival. I know yes, she had self-inflicted harm, you know, scars. She'd obviously been cutting herself and due to her abuse. But the Beast sees that and just decides to let her go because of that. But I thought the whole, you know, all these flashbacks with her dad and her experiences with her uncle, like she was going to, like, you know, take control. I thought that's what they were building for, like her finally taking control of her life, and this lesson would apply, you know, carry on. And in some ways it may or may not, based off where they leave her with the uncle and the police officer at the end, right? But she just gets let go by the Beast. And I think that would, to have your protagonist not be an active participant in their you know, triumph at the end falls a little short, especially because there was so much build up to it. At least that's how I interpret it, as I said. So to me, that's what gets at that half step under perfect. 4.5 out of 5 glass canes for me.
Because this wasn't the movie that you would have made, you're gonna hurt it for that?
That is correct.
Okay.
Just for clarification, we're joking. I think we both are on the same page about what I'm talking about.
So. Yes, yes. Excellent. Well, I'm going to give this the same rating that I gave Unbreakable. I'd give this a 4. I did really enjoy the movie. I thought it was very good. And I'm really glad that I finally got around to watching this. I don't know if I would have had we not done it for this. Probably because it had that stigma of it being the loose sequel to Unbreakable. And I mean, I didn't want to see a sequel to Unbreakable. So I think that's the reason why I never got around to it, even once I found out what that was. And when I heard Glass was coming out, I still made no effort to go and see this and whatnot, even though I do really enjoy Shyamalan a lot as a director. So,
All right, well then, Brendan, let me ask you this. Is this franchise fatigued?
Okay, so I'm a little bit torn on this because, honestly, as much as I am intrigued to see where they're going with Glass because it's out, if this came out, again, yes, like I said, with them revealing that this is in the Unbreakable universe, I don't care. So yes, honestly, yes, this franchise is fatigued at this point, and the only reason I'm going to see this third one is because I'm curious. But yes, I would say this is fatigued at this point.
Well, you don't want to see what they're doing with the Horde. I mean, he's out there. He's, you know, out there potentially to keep doing what he's been trying during this whole movie. So,
sure.
All right. Last for me, I'm going to say no, because they have a lot of unresolved plot threads. Like I said, I would have been fine if we actually didn't revisit the character of Casey and just kind of left it hanging there of like, oh, what is she going to speak up? Is she going to... finally break free of her, you know, cycle of abuse from her uncle. Like, these are, you know, just hanging it there is pretty powerful, I think. So I really like that decision they made in this film. But the Horde needs a follow-up because he's out there, right? And he's going to show himself to the world. That was their big deal. Like, oh, they'll have to believe us now, right? When he's examining himself at the end, all the personalities are talking to each other in the mirrors. I thought that was pretty effective there. Mm-hmm. And also with the huge hook, the tease of David Dunn from Unbreakable. Like, you can't have that and then not set up a third film. And that's
right.
And that's going to give me exactly what I had wanted since Unbreakable. Oh, this is great. You have someone who, you know, breaks people and someone who is unbreakable, right? Because, you know, you see how he killed his psychiatrist. That's not going to work on David Dunn. So we'll see how it flies in the next film. So, no, this franchise is not fatigued. I'm very happy this was a big success and they ended up making a third one. And we'll talk about what we think about that one next time.
I predict that water will play a role in the climax of the next film.
You have to watch Glass and find out.
I should probably watch Glass. Yeah. Thank you so much to Ken Tripp and Tony Robinson for being executive producers of the network United Federation of Podcasts. Thank you so much to Zach Tripp for making our wonderful theme music. Please support us on Patreon. For $3 a month, you get early releases. For $5 a month, you get an exclusive commentary on Star Trek episodes with Zach and myself. And please, please, pretty pleased with Sugar on Top. Can you give us a rating and review? It doesn't take much time to do, and it does brighten our lives.
So, Brendan, when you aren't talking to yourself, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter, at Brandon Metella. You can find me over on the Trek FM network with a show called The Line, which is all about Star Trek Picard. You can find me on Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast, available in its own independent feed, as well as in the master feed for the Fandom Podcast Network. There, my friends Chris and Tom and myself, we talk about Hitch's films in chronological order. And coming soon over on the Nerd Party Network, John Mills, Tristan Riddell, and myself are doing a show called House of Fincher, which is all about David Fincher's films, and it's a whole heck of a lot of fun. Zach, where can people find you when you're not peeing yourself to prevent yourself from dancing for me?
Well, you can find me personally on Twitter at MoronZach. That's MoronZach. I'm also the host of my own podcast, Always Sullen of Smallville. You can find us on Twitter at AlwaysSmallville with one S.
Well, that's all we've got for you this week. Until next time, when we cover the film Glass, I'm the Beast,
etc., etc.
This has been a production of MTMR Media Works.